This is the 29th class in the Then and Now series on Tuesday, May 6th, 2008. Some of you may have noticed I sent out an email, or at least to everybody on Facebook, saying how many of you are actually listening to the podcasts, and asked them for a number of questions about what they were finding of value, and got back. I've had about 10 replies, 8 to 10 or so far, and they've actually been very positive. I printed one of them out this evening, but I forgot to bring it with me, because the person was expressing very much her appreciation for the participation of you in the questions and answers and so forth. And she feels like she's got to know everybody. And so when somebody gives a reply, she goes, "Yes, that's right." And good point, Julia, and things like that. So so that's what's going on. Another person said he doesn't find the discussion helpful at all, but that's one out of 7 or 8 replies. So that's definitely the minority. Okay, the question I left you with, if I recall correctly, was the difference between acting morally because it was the natural thing to do and acting morally because you knew it was the right thing to do. Is that right? I remembered it pretty well.
Yes.
Thank you, Joe. So, Joe.
this is more termed in doing the right thing because it's the moral thing to do. Doing the right thing because it's the natural.
Interesting. To do. Okay. Thank you. Okay. That's all right. So, how was this? This is actually a fairly subtle one. So.
It's extremely subtle. I mean, first thing I would like to have
the words. Moral, ethical, virtue, and hell banned from any translation of Buddhist texts now and henceforth always.
The reason for imposing this moral juncture injunction on the Buddhist texts on translators is
that for me, my particular background, these terms are so weighted, it's so have such a cultural baggage that it's hard to contemplate them without positing an external applier of these.
An external authority.
Yes, a punisher.
We should talk about this a bit. Okay. So why do you cling to these outdated notions?
Why do I cling to them? Your suggestion is that I can just let them go.
I'm feeling feisty, though, in case you hadn't noticed. Yes.
Yes. I must find them useful or somehow attractive in some way.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
How do you find them useful and attractive? I think that's, we have to be a little careful in our wording here. What use does holding on to them serve? This is a non-trivial question. You may recall Stephen Batchelor wrote his most recent book, I think a new one's coming out shortly, Living with the Devil, in which he explores quite deeply the notions of right and wrong, good and evil. Good and evil, I think it is, in Buddhism. Because, as he says in the introduction, he found these two skeletons rattling around in his closet. And I read the book, and I have a great deal of respect and affection for Stephen. We've had a number of very good conversations. But I found myself disagreeing with immensely with a lot of the things that he was saying until he got the section on Taoism and balance and no good and evil existing, etc. And I realized that those two skeletons aren't rattling around in my closet, but they do rattle around in a lot of people's. And that's what I'm, how I'm understanding you. So what does, you know, what would you have to, what price would you have to pay to clear out your closet?
Well, let me make my response more clear, because I'm not sure that I may be going down a road which I don't really mean.
Okay.
What it does is it slows up. It's not that I cling to them. It's that they pop up and they block me for a while. My understanding and my ability to apply the suggestions made in a text like this because of those words. And then what I do is I say, well, this whole set of rules is as provisional as any set of rules I have ever ingested and taken on in my life and rejected at some point. And I immediately go to, well, what is my experience in the moment of what can I do again that is the right thing or the moral thing, to use those words, in this moment, at any given moment, when I'm sitting on the cushion, when I'm driving my car, when mm-hmm. I'm with other people. And what relationship does that have to these rules that are supposedly made up? And my conclusion is that these rules are only useful insofar as they bring one into the present moment and knowing their own experience.
Yes. This is helpful. Okay. There are things that I think it'll be good to speak to in your response there. Okay. Anybody else with this one? Randy. It's on.
When you gave the assignment, I thought I knew what you were talking about. And then I walked out of here and realized I didn't. And I spent some time trying to differentiate moral and right and natural. And I found that very difficult to do. I wasn't interpreting right as right and wrong, but rather appropriate behavior, more so rather than a wrong meaning misbehavior. But that's kind of where I got stuck. I really couldn't tease them apart very well.
Okay. Anybody else? Alex?
I guess I would say that I sometimes feel trying to do the right thing is sometimes there's kind of a feeling of sort of a conflict. I guess, as you were saying, it's maybe very subtle and I think kind of beyond me to understand.
Thank you for your honesty. Okay. Alita, you messed with this one at all? Elena? Elena, I'm sorry. I'm terrible with names.
Yeah, it took me a few days to get into the whatever you were asking. Well, every time I think about the right thing to do, whatever it is, there's always some, you know, some moral questions coming up. Always.
Moral what? Questions?
Questions. Always. They seem very attached to each other. Then, depending on what, I might end just being sort of freed, you know, from that. But other times it just doesn't happen. And it usually happens when there's a stronger, I guess, relationship to the people probably I'm dealing with, you know. So that's pretty much it. But it makes me feel very confused, though.
Okay. Susan.
I had a real life situation that I was able to subject this to or use for this. And what ended up happening is that what conventionally was supposed to be right was wrong, and what is conventionally defined as wrong turned out to be right, and it's because the knowing knew that. And the discomfort that I was feeling and kind of wrestling with this situation had to do with my, I guess you'd call it my conditioning, fighting the knowing.
Yeah. You have anything to say, Kara?
I think I kind of I think I kind of wrestled with it this week. I don't know. I definitely had a couple of situations where I felt sort of at an impasse as to what was the moral answer versus the right answer to questions. And I think sometimes when I wrestle with that, I have a tendency to throw myself under the bus in the name of what might be right for someone else, and that can be kind of an unhealthy conundrum. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Right. Well, let's see if some of this gets straightened out as we go through this chapter this evening. Turning to Joe's first point, or before we turn to that point, I think it'd be good to look at the translation point that you're raising, because there are some important translation points in here. I want to step, take a big step backwards, and look at things from a slightly larger perspective, which I think also speaks to some of the points here. There's a Russian scholar, may have been Shestrabatsky, but I can't remember, who observed that any religious formulation of a religion, five things have to be accounted for. What is the source of being? How is the world created? What is the source of moral authority? Who determines, or how is it determined whether you're acting morally or not? And who or what rewards or punishes you? Now, many of these are the one can use the legal analogy for. You have the judge, the prosecutor, and the executioner. Put it very literally or dramatically. Now, in most religions, particularly the Abrahamic religions, all of these are vested in God, or Allah, or Yahweh, or what have you. In Buddhism, it's quite different. The source of being is, in some schools of Buddhism, regarded as emptiness. In other schools, it's regarded as empty clarity. Subtle difference, which we don't need to go into. But basically, the source of being is open, clear awareness. Empty awareness. The other four are all ascribed to karma, which is not a person, but is simply a process. Do you follow? And this makes Buddhism... I don't know how it would break down in Hinduism. I just don't know enough about Hinduism. But the... Well, you do have creators, in like Indra or Vishnu.
Brahma. It just depends on what you're...
Yeah. But the... and you have the destroyer, of course, which is Shiva. But the... okay. So anyway, all religious traditions do this. And Buddhism is a little different because there isn't any person that is regarded as or any figure which is saying this is right and this is wrong. Now, there's a lot of people who will disagree with me on that, so I need to qualify it, which I will in a moment. There's just the way things work. And so, and from this point of view, karma is a bit like gravity. It's just a principle which governs how experience arises and evolves, actually, in the same way that gravity governs how bodies move in relationship with each other, unless they're extremely small and then the atomic forces take over. When I say there isn't a person... there are a number of people who would say that, well, Buddha said, you know, these actions are right and these actions are wrong. But if you scratch that a little more deeply, you find that there are actually two notions of right and wrong. There are actions which are right and wrong because they are just right or wrong, and that's in working with the keeping of the way karma works. So it's not someone saying they're right and wrong, it's just that if you do these things, then these... they evolve into these kinds of experiences. And then there are the actions which are right and wrong because one's made a personal commitment, and that is such as the vows of ordination. So, you know, having a partner and is not in itself right or wrong, but if you've taken ordination as a monk or a nun, then it becomes wrong for you to do that because you've made a personal commitment to a certain way of life. You follow? So... that's one piece, which actually is a very different way of looking at things from the way that we're used to in our culture. The second thing, and when you start going through the text, I'll point this out, is the approach that we take to morality. And I have certain problems with the notion of morality. Also, I often favor the word discipline as opposed to moral because I think actually it's better, and especially reading this chapter this time, I think it may be the better term. But there are people who do things, you know, act morally or observe moral vows because they feel that they're going to get something from doing so, like some kind of reward, and be punished if they don't. When you take this approach to morality, to our behavior, how we act, we're actually taking a very childish approach. This is how a child acts. A more mature and appropriate way is because we see that acting this way is skillful. That is, it produces better results. Not that we're going to be rewarded for it. It just is the way that is appropriate to act. And so we start acting that way, not because it's going to bring some kind of reward in the future, but because it is the right thing to do in each moment, or the appropriate thing to do in each moment. And so there's a shift away from that authoritarian to a very natural kind of thing. That's what I want to try and bring out in through this. Now, does this address some of the issues that were raised? Okay. Well, it's six of one, half dozen of the other, which translation here, so we'll probably use both again. We are on page 163 in Gunter. And 196 in Kensho Jaltsen. Now, we have the same headings as we had for generosity, and we'll have the same seven headings for each of the six perfections. And we also had a brief discussion last time about rational choice theory. And you can see that it just goes through the same kind of thing, like all of these good things are going to happen if you practice discipline or moral discipline, whatever you want to call it, and all of these bad things are going to happen if you don't. But in reading through these, I think it's... even though that's how Gampopa is presenting it, there is a deeper meaning which is implicit in each one of the quotations. So I just want to take some of these and try to point to what I'm discerning as the deeper meaning. And again, what I'm trying to do here is show you how to read these texts so that you just don't feel like somebody's wagging a finger at you all the time. Because it's easy to read them, like thinking, no, you do this and you don't do that, and you do this and you don't do that. Do you remember Polonius and Hamlet, you know? Yes. Okay, so if you take the first one, even if one achieves wealth through generosity, the being who breaks his leg of moral ethics will fall to the lower realms. Okay, that sounds like a really bad thing. The way that I would read this is that the exercise of restraint or discipline, and we'll be talking, restraint is one form of discipline, but say the exercise of discipline is how you start stepping out of conditioned behavior. Because if you don't exercise any discipline at all, then you just do what is conditioned. Do you follow? Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's the point that's being pointed here. It's not that you're doing something wrong, is that if you don't start doing something other than conditioned behavior, then you're just going to end up in, you know, reacting in situations out of anger, greed, or instinct. And then you take the next one. For example, a person without sight cannot see forms. Likewise, a person with moral ethics will not see the Dharma teachings. Here, what I think is being the point that's being made is that when you're exercising discipline, you really have to look at things more carefully. So you actually bring more attention to each situation because of the value you place on acting appropriately in it. You can't just say, oh, I feel like doing this. You really have to, okay, what is the situation? What are the implications internally, externally, et cetera, so forth? And so you bring much more attention to the action. Next one on the top of 196 in Kensho Jaltsen's book, translation, a person without feet cannot walk a road. Likewise, a person without moral ethics cannot be liberated. Again, what I would tend to, how I'd intend to understand this is that your feet provide you with a method of movement. And the exercise of discipline gives you a way of moving in your life. And so with those examples, I think you may be able to... well, now he's moving into why it's a good thing. So let's just get down. Just as the ground is the basis for motion and stillness, so moral ethics is the basis of excellent qualities. Now, Kensho Jaltsen uses the translation moral ethics. It's I don't know how they arrived at that. It doesn't. The word in Tibetan is tsul trim. Tsul is way, and trim, the way or the mode of doing things, and trim is the word for rules, really, laws and so forth. I favor discipline over just simple morality. There's a standard of behavior you're aspiring to, and that requires some kind of discipline. Do you follow? And we're going to get more into that. So if you read this instead, just as the ground is the basis for motion and stillness, discipline is the basis of all excellent qualities. It makes a lot more sense right there, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Okay, Steve, did you have a question?
My only problem with that is you can be very disciplined in immoral acts or in training to do immoral acts. So just the word discipline to me doesn't connect with morality or ethics.
Okay. Okay, we can say moral discipline, I suppose. Skipping a bit further down, for one who keeps pure moral ethics or moral discipline, all aspiration prayers will be accomplished. I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I'm going to throw this one out to you. How do you see that one working? Anybody?
Well, that's actually a response to what Steve just said. If you make an aspiration, that's where your discipline is directed towards.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're disciplined to, I hate to use the word achieve.
Well, yeah, and I don't think we need to use the word achieve. I've been reading a book called The Illusion of Conscious Will, which I got out of the library and started in and promptly ordered a copy from Amazon so I'd have it in my own library, but I'm not sure I should have, because but Amazon's so fast that I'm stuck with it now. It'll be here in a couple of days. This is a huge amount of research which purports to show that the idea of doing something consciously is an illusion. And there's some very, very interesting data that are observing. But as I'm reading it, and I'm only a third of the way through it, so this is very provisional. It may change entirely by next week. Uh, we actually have no idea where our actions come from. We tend to think, as if I say, okay, I'm going to move my hand this way, that it's my thinking that makes the hand move way. But it may be that my thinking that and the movement of the hand are both coming from something deeper in us. Do you follow? Mm-hmm. Now, I think this is very important because this tallies with my own experience of how change takes place in us, is that we set an intention. So it's not that we just decide to do things and then do them. We all know that would it were so easy, but it just doesn't work like that because there are these deep forces in us which keep taking us off in different directions against seemingly our will. You know, we're talking about conditioning and so forth. But when you set an intention, which is like fostering an aspiration in a certain sense, then more and more facets of our being become entrained in that, and eventually we start moving in that direction. That's what I think this is referring to. Now, Steve's point is quite right, that one can do that into reactive and negative ways of acting just as much as one can do it into positive. But it's not so much that what we decide to do in each moment, because not quite sure where that's coming from, but we can, by consciously setting an intention and fostering things, then we begin to, like, turn the ship, so to speak. Kara, you got a question?
I was just wondering if that was based on some kind of, like, gestalt theory of...
No, this is actual measurements. I have a few questions about the research methods, but the data that's being reported is that if you put an electrode on your finger and record when the muscle movement starts, that's about 500 milliseconds before the finger actually moves and before you become aware of the movement. You become aware of wanting to move about 200 or 300 milliseconds before. So the finger has actually started to move almost quarter of a second before you are aware of wanting to move the finger.
So is that like correlated to... This is totally off topic. Is that like correlated to people who are paralyzed or have Tourette's? Or?
Oh, there's some interesting research done on things like phantom limbs and coordinating that. It also says a lot about... baseball and tennis and very high-speed sports, is that they don't decide... The decision to swing and how to swing is made way, way before it is actually being processed consciously.
Because it's habit.
And it's trained. Right. But it's not happening. I am going to swing this way. So anyway... the bottom of page 196. Pure moral ethics bear great beneficial effects. Because of that, it is not difficult to establish enlightenment. Oof, I have so many troubles with that translation. Let's see what Gunter does. Since pure ethics and manners are very useful, the realization of enlightenment is not difficult. Well, praise. Gunter is actually closer to English than Kencho Jeltsin here. I think both of them are missing the point. I should have checked the Tibetan here, but just from reading these, I think the sense is acting morally engages your energy. And because it engages your energy, it sets things in motion in the direction that you're intending to go. Okay, now, yes?
I did note that Gunther, in the previous chapter, said virtually the same thing about liberality, about generosity. And there's a flavor that these are sort of standalone paramitas, that if you get one, you're going to be able to achieve enlightenment. I'm being slightly facetious, but there's a real separation feeling, and we have four more to go.
Well, both hold, in my opinion. Any one of these is a path. And a viable path at that. So you can, when it comes down to practice, one really has a choice of practicing all of them, which is very good. But if you really practice any one of them, you will end up practicing all of them. Because I think that was made in the introductory section, introducing the six perfections. You know, you have the generosity of morality and the morality of morality and the patience of morality, etc., etc. So any one of them becomes a path, and some people may choose to make generosity a path. But if they choose to make generosity a path, then they're exercising that path defines a moral sense around generosity. It also requires a certain amount of patience, etc. Do you see what I mean? Okay. The next is the classification of the essence of ethics and manners, point number two. And this is very interesting. You see, the four points breaks down to accept properly from others, to be inspired by pure motivation, to mend one's ways once one has fallen from one's code, and to avoid so falling by being mindful and devoted. And you see that these are organized into acceptance and preservation. And the first one is acceptance, the other three are preservation. That's fairly straightforward. But I think it's good to look at this, that the notion or a way of acting in the world is something that we learn from others. And it may be through the formal vows of a monk or the bodhisattva vows, or it may be informally, as it often is with many aspects. But it is. But we learn from others about a way of living in the world, and then it is up to us to do the other three, to be inspired by that. That's our internal process. To remedy it when we fall away from it, and to live our life in such a way that we fall away from it less and less. You follow? So I hadn't thought about this until I was reading this in preparation for it, but in a fairly explicit way, Gampopa here is pointing to the fact that moral discipline, or whatever you want, is learned, and it's learned through interaction, through community. It isn't something that exists off by itself. Do you follow? Okay. Then the next one, Susan, did you have a question?
I think I might be a little confused, because I thought the idea was that there was no external authority that was telling, handing a set of behaviors down, and now you're saying that there is.
Not exactly. Good point to raise, though. You remember the story of Buddha before he became Buddha? Left the city and saw an ill person, an old person, and a corpse. And then he saw a fourth person, the mendicant, who is completely at peace. He saw, how is that possible? That's what really awakened the spiritual questions in him. Like, how is it possible when you have all of the suffering to be at peace? And this just blew his mind and caused him to renounce everything and go search for an answer to that question. So we see someone who is at peace in the world and we observe how they are living. That isn't the same, that isn't an authority saying you have to live this way. But it is that we learn about living this way from an example of another person. And so we receive that knowledge through our association with that person or people. But that's different from there being a right way, a set of rules through which we have to follow. Set of rules is a much later step in the evolution of this, and that's when things become pretty restrictive. We're going to be talking about that. Do you see the distinction I'm making?
I do. I mean, I thought that this was more. Well, you had also mentioned earlier. Meeting each moment, resting in your own knowing or awareness. So that's not, I mean, I guess you could see somebody else who's doing that and be inspired by it, but if it's different for each person in each person's own life and own moments.
Exactly. But that's what you would learn from hanging out with someone. First you would start emulating behavior, but then you'd realize that doesn't quite do the job.
Mm-hmm.
And think, well, and so you start talking with this person. They say, well, I'm not following a set of rules here. I'm bringing my attention to bear in each moment. So each moment tells me what the right thing to do is.
Ah, okay.
And so, oh, well, that's a different. I mean, there are many people that I've gone through exactly that process with. And you raised your example from earlier this evening was just such a point where they'll come and say, well, I have this situation, but I know that the right thing to do is this, but this doesn't feel right because of X, Y, and Z. And so we'll just explore it. And eventually they'll come down to the point, this is what I have to do, and it doesn't really matter what all the rules say because this is what the right thing to do is in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of the work is helping them find the confidence to act on that knowing. And you know from your own experience that's can be challenging sometimes.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. This threefold classification of ethics, we're at the top of page 165 in Gunther. This is a very classical classification. Acquiring the good and wholesome, working for the benefit of all sentient beings, A, restraint, B, acquiring the good and wholesome, and C, working for the benefit of all sentient beings. Kinchok Jeltsin's translations are moral ethics of restraint or the moral discipline of restraint, morality of accumulating virtuous dharma, and morality of benefiting sentient beings. Again, translations really miss the point. The first one about restraint, there's no problem with that. We restrain ourselves from actions we know set in motion a problematic process of evolution, of karma. So that one's fairly straightforward. The next one, We've discussed this a bit before in respect to the two accumulations and so forth. It's neither. I don't feel either the words accumulating or acquiring are right. I would say I much prefer to regard this as generating the good and wholesome in us and in the world we experience. And we all know from our own experience that when we do things that generate the good and the wholesome, that has an effect on us and on those around us. It opens things up. It makes a lot of other things possible that weren't possible and so forth. And then working for the benefit of all sentient beings, this is very, very misleading. To me, it's misleading because it implies an agency. That is, we're working for the benefit of sentient beings. Again, I think it's appropriate to remember that when we're talking about all sentient beings, we're talking about mythic language. It's poetry. If we translate that from the mythic language, you know, all sentient beings out there, to all aspects of our own mind, we've done this translation before, what does this mean? That's a question. Yes, I gathered that was the response at this point. That's why I think I had to say it. It's a question, okay? How would you translate benefiting all sentient beings into non-mythic language? This is the whole point I've been trying to get across to you guys for the last year. Thank you, Kara. You gonna care to take a stab at it, Joe?
Sure. Said in a totally different way, the best thing we can do for all sentient beings is to achieve enlightenment. In fact, the only thing we can do for all sentient beings is to whatever achieve enlightenment means.
Okay.
And that's the aspect of our own mind, you know, to work in that way. So that's an outcome to be sought.
I'm waiting for the translation.
Oh, the actual translation. The book translation.
The translation of this phrase, working for the benefit of all sentient beings, or brings all sentient beings to full spiritual maturity. What I'm suggesting, and the position I'm taking, is that this is mythic language, and I would like it to be translated into non-mythic language. Anybody? Art?
It's opening the... How do I want to say this? The totality of one's experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's perhaps the way to put it. It is working to liberate the totality of one's experience.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, when it says... to bring all sentient beings to full enlightenment or full awakening, to translate that into non-mythic language, one way would be to wake up in every aspect of our own mind. You follow? So the only way we can do that is to regard no aspect of our mind as an enemy, and to work to bring every aspect or awakening into every aspect of our own experience, the way that Art was saying. Randy.
This was an interesting one as a psychologist of not rejecting parts of ourself in the sense that we accept pieces, we reject pieces, learning how to let go of that, the only way to do is by seeing very clearly what is actually there.
That's right.
Okay.
And we will see when we do that, that every piece of us, even the parts that are really hurt and angry and don't behave very well, actually probably arose for a very definite purpose at a certain point of time. And they just...
They're inappropriate.
Yeah, but they're still acting. And so bringing all of that into balance is one way of looking at what the task of waking up is about.
And you can't learn to let go of what's out there until you learn how to let go of what's in here.
Well, I would go a bit further than that. To let go of something out there, we have to see what its reflection is in us. So it's all about letting go in here rather than letting go out there. Okay. Okay. Is this clear? Okay, good. You have the primary characteristics of each type of ethics. You have common and uncommon. I think it'd be better to say common and special. Now, what I find interesting here is that what's called the common, and this is the ethics of restraint, or the discipline of restraint, however you want to regard it. The common, this is basically the what's called the vows of individual freedom, and refers, it's the basis of the monastic discipline. But the paragraph in the middle of page 165 in Gunther is very important. Ethics or discipline not to be observed for the sake of kingship, the bliss of heaven, the position of Indra, Brahma, or Ishvara, nor for the enjoyment of wealth, for the world of forms and other experiences. So you're not doing this in because you're going to get these good results out of it. Again, this is the childish approach. They are not observed out of fear of hell, of rebirth among animals, or of the world of Yama. Again, it's a very childish approach. On the contrary, ethics are observed in order to become like the Buddhas and to bring profit and happiness to all sentient beings. That is, ethics are observed because that is simply what is to be done. Now, an example, this may not seem entirely analogous, but perhaps it's useful. Suppose you're a doctor. You come across a person who has broken their arm or needs some first aid. You don't perform the surgery or the treat this person because you're hoping something good is going to happen to you. You don't treat this person because you fear something bad is going to happen to you. You treat this person because you have the skills and the know-how, and that is what is to be done. And this is the more mature approach to morality and discipline, as far as I'm concerned, that as we begin to wake up, we see, oh, this is what needs to be done here, this is what needs to be done here. And the notion of gaining some kind of reward or being punished in some way becomes increasingly less and less a motivation for us. Karen, did you have a point?
No, I have a question, and this is something that we've discussed. I don't know if we've discussed it on the podcast before, but in especially in generosity and now with this, I have a real hard time because I have friends in the city who practice another form of Buddhism that is a very disciplined and diligent practice, but at the same time is very much focused on if I do X, I'm going to get Y. And I put my energy on Y. Like, I'm going to do my practice because I need to make money. And if I put that energy out in the universe, I'm going to make money. And so they're a very, like, much more iconoclastic set. And when I try to dialogue with them about, you know, I don't want to say our belief system, but the way that I choose to practice, it tests my moral limits not to yell at them.
Okay. Now.
Call them children.
Pardon?
And call them children.
And call them children. Well, what's your investment?
This group of people tends to be pretty high and mighty about the superiority of their practice.
So?
I don't like that.
What sticks in your craw?
I guess on the base level that I don't understand the purpose of saying my Buddhism is better than your Buddhism.
Yeah, from your point of view, there's no purpose to that. So what do you feel for someone who feels there is a purpose to that?
Depending on my mood, sometimes I feel sort of sorry for them. Sometimes I'm just glad that they have a practice. I feel like on an intellectual level, if I step back and I look at it, what I find disheartening is that it would never occur to me to sit down and meditate because I want to make money. But because I feel like that energy could be much, I don't want to say better appropriated, but it's not just for me. And it's not about me.
Okay. All right.
And there he's are two, laughing at me.
No, I'm not laughing at you at all. There are two points here. They found a path. You may not agree with the basis of the path or their motivation or whatever, etc. But the fact remains that they have found a path which is causing them to do less harm and more good. Okay, period. Okay? So that's one piece. The second piece is you can't comprehend practicing out of what for you would be a lower form of motivation. Okay? Why do you get angry? There's a difference here. Why do you get angry about it?
Pride.
Yeah, probably.
I don't like feeling like I'm being talked down to because it's usually, I grew up in a very, very rigidly Christian environment and was constantly on the opposite end of, do you want to go to church with me? And you do realize that if you keep that up, you're going to burn in hell, you know, stuff like that. And I would smile and nod and, you know, go about my business. And I had never, having lived in Buddhist countries, had never experienced that from another Buddhist. This notion that
the group that you're talking about borrowed Christian fundamentalist methods.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. But I do think that, I mean, I certainly, you know, I don't mean to in any way slight them, because I do think that there are people that do good within it. But at the same time, in talking about that within this framework, I find it...
Yes. There's something in you find painful and difficult to experience.
Right.
that's your work. Okay, whatever that is. Okay, and we'll get moving into this direction in the next little bit. The next part, and we'll go back to Kensho Jeltsin's because they made the list more complete here. This is on page 198. And you see you have this list of 18 downfalls, the 5 downfalls for a king, 5 for ministers, 8 for subjects, and so forth. Now, and later on, further down, you see there's a list of 46, which are Kensho Jeltsin included in an appendix, page 443. All of these are very much connected with the Bodhisattva vow, and these are regarded as the precepts. I want to get away from that word. The guidelines and training of a Bodhisattva is to restrain from this list of 18, this list of 46. When you read through such a list, I think it's very important to remember what we've already discussed about moral discipline. And that is, in Buddhism, moral discipline, and this goes to the point you were raising earlier, Joe, is descriptive, not prescriptive. That is, it describes how an awake person behaves. It's not saying you have to behave this way. And this is why the use of the term precepts as a translation, I think, is very problematic, because you know, you adopt those precepts and these are the things I'm being told to do. When you go look down this list, I mean, most of them are pretty straightforward, but take a look at G, for instance. Expressing emptiness to beings who are not fully trained. This is actually a very important thing, because if you introduce that notion to people before they have a maturity, it's in their own experience to understand what you're pointing to, it can shut things down really hard for quite a long time, because the only way it can be interpreted is as a form of nihilism, which is not what it's about at all. And you skip down to something like where is one? Well, K's a good example. Expressing one's good qualities in order to get wealth, honor, praise, and to abuse others. Well, this is a form of harsh language, actually. It's a very subtle form, because you aren't really saying anything bad about somebody. You're just saying how good you are, but the implication is that somebody else is bad. And basically, you're manipulating people when you do this. So rather than looking at these as this rule, this rule, this rule, this rule, you look at what are they actually pointing to. Each one of these points to a very specific internal way in which we are blocking our own spiritual growth internally. I think that's the best way to say it. So you take a look at the last one. Disrupting someone in calm abiding meditation, or taking the provisions of a retreat practitioner and giving them someone who says prayers. Suppose you're an abbot. It's an injunction as to where you put the resources. Do you put them into people who are doing rituals, or do you put them into people who are trying to wake up? And so all of these have a spirit behind them, and that's what I would encourage you to look at. What is the deeper meaning, the deeper significance? And also, it is very helpful to look at these as applying to oneself internally. So if you take this last one, disrupting someone in calm abiding meditation, or taking the provisions of a retreat practitioner and giving them to someone who says prayers. Okay, when do you do this internally? How often do you disrupt or disturb your own stillness? Well, we do it all the time. How often do we divert resources and opportunities in our life for practice into something else? We do that all the time. I've got retreat coming up, and we've got Molly sent me an email from someone who said, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to make it. Something's come up in my life. And well, this happens all the time. And Rinpoche, when we would say this all the time, is that when we do good, when we do virtue, that is, when we start moving in the direction of awakening, we come into contact with the momentum of all the patterns that are keeping us in a reactive mode of life, of living. And it feels like we're stirring stuff up, but it's just that we've started to move in a different direction, so now all of that stuff becomes noticed in a way that we didn't notice before. Do we work in continue with our intention, or do we allow that momentum to carry us back into the stream, precisely the stream from which we're trying to move out of? So all of these guidelines can be interpreted internally that way. And that's moving them out of the somewhat mythic or poetic language in which they're phrased, and also moving them away from a literal interpretation into an indication of how to undertake the internal journey. Molly?
I just wanted to know the difference between what someone who says prayers versus a retreat practitioner.
Well, the way I would interpret this, I'm not 100% this is what it's referring to. If you think of your own meditation, you can be in the Tibetan tradition, you could spend hours and hours and hours reciting prayers. And people did. And, you know, some people had daily prayers, literally a stack that thick, that they would recite every day, or do recite every day. It's called verbal recitation. That's one form of practice. You're reading these things, many of which are deeply inspiring, very instructive, and so forth. And by reading them over and over again, you're actually absorbing them. So there's definite benefit in that. But there's quite another level of benefit, which comes when you look at your own mind and you see nothing is there, and you just rest in that looking, so that you're deeply absorbing and instilling the knowledge, the knowing, that you are not anything. You are simply awareness directly through one's own experience. That's what a retreat practitioner refers to.
So maybe retreat practitioner meditates, and someone who says prayers, they just
reciting things, which is a beneficial activity, but it's not on the same order. Okay. All right, and then you can read over the 46 in the appendix yourself. How are we doing for time, Joe? We've got a lot to cover. Yow. Okay. Do my best. The next one is relatively short. It's the moral ethics of, and I would prefer to say generating goodness here, generating the good and wholesome. And again, this is generating an internal environment in which things can grow and flourish, and the seeds that we're cultivating can actually grow. I don't think there's anything too mysterious about that. Then we move to the discipline of benefiting sentient beings. This is in section C on page 199 in Kenchok Jaltsen. Supporting meaningful activities, dispelling the suffering of those sentient beings who are suffering, showing the methods to those who do not know them, recollecting others' kindness and then repaying it, etc. Again, I think it is well worthwhile approaching these both as things we do in the world and ways that we work internally at the same time. And then it goes into considerable detail of how you comport yourself in the world in order to live being awake. And I think the descriptive side of this comes out very, very strongly here. So you look at how a body... how your the guidelines for physical actions. You're quiet physically. There's a sense of discipline and relaxation and composure, and you can almost feel the quality of peace that's being created as you read through these. And I think that's, I should desist from inconsiderate and noisily moving around chairs and so forth, as well as from violently opening doors. I should always delight in humility. You get the idea, Joe?
I just wanted to remark on how extraordinarily different it is when it's phrased in the first person than it is when it's phrased as something everybody should do, or more mm-hmm. correctly, you should do. When in the more poetic form, as in the Bodhicharya
Vitara, exactly.
It's much, to me personally,
yeah,
it's much more effective than in this form of a precepts.
Because you're describing your behavior rather than saying, you know, I have to do this and this and this.
Right, and it's also a person talking to oneself, which is what we should all do, as opposed to saying what anybody else should do.
Yeah. And do remember, in doing this, what you're doing here is creating an environment for awakening to take place. It's not about following a set of rules. It's about creating an environment. And then the same thing for speech. Now, I want to throw a caution in here. The way that you actually do this is not by adopting modes of behavior, because that can produce a contrived surface level. It's like trying to smile intentionally. An intentional smile doesn't work, and it doesn't work because it doesn't involve many of the muscles that take place in a natural smile, because a lot of those muscles are involuntary and are unwilled. If you just smile, it doesn't have the same effects. That's why you see model smiles and actresses smiles, and they're extraordinarily skilled actors. Politicians, yes, okay. Who are you thinking of? Okay. So... what I'm saying there is that the way that you actually practice this is you bring attention to how am I moving my body, how am I speaking, listening to the sound of your own voice, feeling the motion of your body as you move. And if you feel the motion of your own body as you move, you will naturally not move things harshly or violently or suddenly because your attention will be in it. And if you listen to the sound of your own voice when you're speaking, there's a self-corrective mechanism that just operates immediately. And you, as soon as you start speaking in an insincere tone, you will hear it and you'll stop. And then you'll think, okay, what do I want to say? And then when you speak, start again, you'll be speaking sincerely. Not because you're trying to speak sincerely, but because you're putting attention into the act of speaking. You see what I'm driving at? This is very, very important because otherwise you're just emulating people rather than having it generated from within one's own experience. And the same is true for mental processes. They're more subtle and more difficult. That's Vajrayana. And the way that that's practiced is really the same way. You come into a situation, suppose your yidam is Avalokiteshvara, the embodiment of awakened compassion. And you're at cooking school, right? So you use your...
All day.
Okay, so you're hanging out with these kids.
Frustrate me.
Pardon?
And they frustrate me.
And they frustrate you, okay?
Okay.
Now, how would Avalokiteshvara interact with these kids?
Probably in a nicer way than I've been as okay. of late.
So when you think of being Avalokiteshvara and interacting, you immediately feel all of the stuff in you that gets in the way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, very important question.
Mm-hmm.
How would Avalokiteshvara work with all that stuff?
I would, either by not getting caught up in it or by just being compassionate with it.
Now, what does it mean to be compassionate with all of that confused internal material? What does that actually mean in practice?
I try not to judge it if I'm confused. I just try to be confused until I'm not confused anymore.
And so, how does that work for you?
Well, the stance that I've taken in class is probably one of being a bit more aggressive and confrontational.
This doesn't sound like you're right in your internal experience,
though. No, I actually think I am right in my internal experience. Instead of, like, I can talk to you about this later, but instead of saying, you're tattling on me because they don't like me and I'm working really hard, you know, instead of making that, like, that sort of victimish statement, if my chef says, show everybody how this is supposed to look because yours is perfect.
You just do it.
And? My mom's going to kill me. And I say, I did this week, and I felt like it was the only way to do it because I was kind of getting pushed around a little bit. I said, this is what your lady fingers are supposed to look like. Now, if this challenges your self-esteem, take it up with Michael. And Michael is my chef. And I said it pretty much with bearing eye contact to the girl that I know had been telling Michael that I was being arrogant.
Yeah. But what if you just let all of that drop?
I think I will next week.
Thank you. And if Michael asks you to do something, you just get up and you do it, and that's it.
Well, Michael wasn't there. It was a different chef. But
and that's what I'm talking about, is that you're not being anybody, and you're not trying to teach anybody anything. and you just, you know, you're asked to demonstrate something, you demonstrate it. And that's it. What about that as a possibility?
That's what I was doing, and that's what got me in trouble.
I don't think so.
Really? Seriously? Okay, like, everybody in the world now knows what I do for a living, but, like, in my first round of baking class, I was so rigid. Like, I was channeling my grandmother, my German grandmother. It was like, if you're unprepared for class, you know, hand gesture for you, like, your problem. And in this class, I really felt like that I was going to take it in stride and be compassionate with people because they're culinary, they're not pastry, they don't know what they're doing, they think it's a slough off class, I'm going to, et cetera, et cetera. And I really walked in there with, like, a pure intention and had no idea that I was alienating people. That's why I was crying after my chef told me that, because I was just like, this is retarded.
Okay. Now, so there was one piece of learning. Now there's another piece of learning.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And this is what happened. This is how we learn how to be in the world in a natural way, which is not off-putting to other people, but is not also not victimizing. And it's very, very much a case of constantly unfolding as we become more and more aware of the stuff inside us that is operating. You look devastated.
I'm not devastated. I'm just... I don't know. It's
okay. But it's the point that I'm trying to bring up, you asked about fake it until you make it. You do that when you act that way, it brings you in touch with the internal material in you, and then you work with that material, just as you said, Avalokiteshvara, okay. It's not judgmental. You work with it very gently. And in this way, by working with both the outside and the internal material as the expression of compassion, things change. And they change in a somewhat magical way because it's not like this causes that. But as we take this more and more deeply, we actually find a different way of being with all of that stuff, which now becomes... is actually much more natural when we discover it. It doesn't come overnight. Randy.
Are morals innate or acquired?
Are morals innate or acquired? Yes.
We have Buddha nature. We have the laws of the way things are that work internally.
These are not in conflict.
Yeah. But the way I've kind of operationalized it for myself, the way I work, is that my task is to sort of get out of my own way, to stop obstructing myself.
Yeah.
And then what will emerge is what I'm looking for. Versus going out and seeking and learning and acquiring ways of behaving.
Well, I think both processes are important. There are skills that we can learn that we don't have. And then there's plenty of stuff we have to just get out of the way in order for those skills to manifest. So I think both sides are important. Some people want to rely on just getting out of the way, and they assume the skills will be there. They may be, and they may not be. There are other people who just want to concentrate on learning skills, but then all the internal material keeps messing things up. So both are important in my view. And when I said... Yes. I find it very... We have to be very careful about asking questions with an or. Are they innate or are they learned?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the answer is almost always both. And when we ask the question or, we're really splitting things into two different things. I mean, you know, this or this. Instead of working with the fact that both of those processes are going on, there is, you know, we often know what the right things do and we just know. But in other cases, it's something that we actually come to appreciate through the maturation of experience. It's something that is learned. So I don't think it's helpful to regard it as this or that. Just wherever it comes from, that's where it comes from. And so there's a person once said to me years and years ago, beware the tyranny of the or and the inclusiveness and appreciate the inclusiveness of and. So they're both innate and learned. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. Last part I want to touch on is the result here. We actually made it through. Sorry to go over. These are just a little bit longer than we can manage in our time. Point six, they are purified when supported by shunyata and compassion, or emptiness and compassion. This is exactly the same point that was made with respect to generosity. This is what transforms. This is what moves it from ordinary morality into the perfection of morality, is that, and this is why I asked you that question from last week, this is where, whether it's restraint, generating goodness, or what is beneficial to beings, arises directly out of the union of emptiness and compassion. It's a non-conceptual, immediate response to what arises. This is something that only that comes about, and going to your point, Randy, it requires deep training in order to be able to access it. But it's possible because there is nothing there, if you follow. Because there is, we are not a thing. We are open awareness. Then the possibility of appropriate action is possible in all situations. Do you follow that? Okay. But in order to be able to do that, we have to train very, very deeply. Because there's so much stuff that gets in the way. Okay. The result is fulfillment and effectiveness in our situation in life. Well, that's true. Moral discipline is a path to awakening in and of itself. And through cultivating discipline, we do become more effective in life because we're able to restrain our behavior when it's appropriate, able to generate good, able to work for the welfare of others. Okay, so we've got through everything. Now, patience. What do you think the assignment should be, Kara? Run around the block 8 times, okay. On the website, you'll find a short song by Milarepa, or actually it's just a verse of a song, in which... how does it go? That's right. I think I've got it right. When you have no sense of ownership, that is the perfection of generosity. Or when you're free from any sense of self, that's the perfection of generosity. When you're free from any sense of shame, that's the perfection of morality or moral discipline. I think for fear... it is for patience. It's when you are free from any sense of fear or when you're able to stand in fear. So what I'd like you to explore over the next week is when you experience impatience, what are you unwilling or afraid of experiencing? When you find yourself being impatient, what are you unwilling or afraid of experiencing? Okay? Very good. See you here next week.
You have just heard a talk by Ken MacLeod, author of Wake Up to Your Life and director of Unfettered Mind, a California nonprofit corporation. This podcast and many others can be found on both iTunes and on the Unfettered Mind website at www.unfetteredmind.org. This podcast is free and has been made available through generous donations from our listeners. We would appreciate any assistance you can offer. Your tax-deductible donations may be made through the Unfettered Mind website, unfetteredmind.org, where you will find translations, articles, information about Buddhism, and other programs given by Ken MacLeod. All rights in this podcast, given by Ken MacLeod, are owned by Unfettered Mind. Unfettered Mind hereby grants you, the listener, the non-exclusive license to listen to and distribute this podcast freely, but only without charge and only if each copy contains all the original contents and these proprietary notices. You may not charge any fee of any kind for making a copy of this podcast available in any form. You may not extract portions of this podcast except for commentary purposes and only if you give proper attribution and this proprietary notice. You may not include this podcast, or any portion thereof, with any other podcasts, talks, information, or data for which any amount is charged. Title, ownership rights, and intellectual property rights in and to this podcast shall remain in Unfettered Mind. This podcast and all elements within it are protected by the copyright laws of the United States and international copyright treaties.